Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the new train keeps gaining momentum. How long can this train keep up steam? Did Nancy Pelosi threaten Newt, or is this just politics as usual in D.C.? Are we seeing the end of the Occupy movement? Is the EU meeting to keep the euro from collapsing? Is it too little, too late? Iran continues to be a powder keg on the international front, which begs the question, is Pakistan a frenemy? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. A mellow start to a really cold and rainy day here in the nation's capital. Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio, Tuesday. It goes for America's premier cigar-smoking, martini-drink political roundtable based in the seat of government in the United States. Joining me, as they always, on my left, he is the former eight-term member of Congress representing the second congressional district of Washington State, the former vice president of Burlington Northern Railroad for government affairs. He's the Honorable Congressman Al Smith. Al,
hello, how are you?
Very mellow start to today's show.
In fact,
you were waiting for the cymbals. Everybody was waiting for cymbals.
Yeah, I was waiting for the cymbals. But how calm you came into the program.
I know, that's not like me. Ah. We should start like this every week.
Well, we're waking up.
To my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, he is former Senator Snyder, he is longtime member of congressional punditry, he is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, welcome back.
Nice to be here on dark, gloomy, wet
day. It is dark and gloomy, yeah, absolutely. To my 12 o'clock, directly across the table from me, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, he is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is Bob Hines. Bob, welcome.
Thanks, Justin. As Alan said, on a gloomy day like this, I can't imagine a better place than Shelley.
No kidding. Smoking a cigar, having a drink, and talking politics amongst friends. And to my right, he is vice president of Eurasia Center. He is a board-certified attorney in the District of Columbia and the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Dr. Ralph, welcome back from several weeks of being gone.
Yep, been away at APEC and had several speaking.
Oh, good. Talk about your trip to G20, too, because that's going to be relevant here in a few seconds. But what we've got on top is some interesting developments on the presidential campaign for the 2012 Republican ticket. Newt Gingrich continues to just be a machine gathering total front-runner status in Iowa, gaining momentum on Mitt Romney in New Hampshire. It's got a lot of people kind of scratching their heads, if you will, about how Newt was able to stave off disaster. Not 3 months ago, his campaign was almost out of cash. Everybody had written him off for dead. And all of a sudden, the political defibrillator hits, and he's now on top of the Republican ticket. I got to go, Bob, how does Newt Gingrich become the front runner?
Because we have so many crazy debates. It's as simple as that. You know, he has always been able to speak well. He has 1,000 ideas. Probably 850 aren't very good, but he is a very good speaker. He's very articulate. He is engaging. He's very bright, and he should not be the nominee.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a second. Congressman Al, right now, certain polls have Newt Gingrich in double margin. I mean, one poll in Florida has him in a runaway, double-digit lead. Iowa's got him up by as much as 9 points. New Hampshire has him gaining ground. Oh, and we've got a birthday. Oh, we've got a birthday celebration.
Not at our table,
but
happy birthday to you.
Woo! Ladies and gentlemen out there in Radio Land, it is Nari's birthday today. Hey, Nari, how old are you? 29? She's not answering. In fact, she's giving me a death look. That's amazing. Alan, our Congressman Al, we're looking at double-digit leads for Newt Gingrich in South Carolina and in Florida. He's gaining momentum on Mitt Romney in New Hampshire. What shocks you about this from the Democratic side?
Well, it's a difficult thing to answer with any objectivity because I served with Newt Gingrich and I made some judgments about it. I think judgments not altogether not held by others who worked with him. And I just think that if people really knew the Gingrich record, they would be less enthusiastic about it. But this is not the first time. There was a congressman I served with that ran in the Democratic primaries last time that I thought was a pluperfect phony. You go back to Estes Kefauver, who was not loved inside the Capitol, but did very, very well in his thing. So it's a case of the information that the insiders know isn't getting to the outside. And for the reasons you articulated very well, he is doing, he's impressing people.
Alan, you've been around Congress for a long time, as we mentioned, from time to time. This has got to surprise you. Every time we write off Newt Gingrich as being politically insignificant, his significance seems to resurrect itself. Is this a testament to his political prowess, or is this just a testament to a disinterested, uninformed electorate?
Well, let's give him some credit for being a very smart and articulate guy. So who showed up very well in the debates against, let's acknowledge, fairly weak competition. Now, having said that, it also speaks to the fact that these other guys have risen and fallen. I mean, the Kane train became the Kane wreck, and we watched that happen.
Can we use that from time to time? Yeah, that was amazing. It was like watching a Kane wreck.
That's right. It was, and we watched, we observed, we called, and now he is gone. These other folks who rose and fell are not necessarily gone, or they don't know it yet. They're still hanging on with a thin thread. So it's speaking, and Romney has held on to a fairly steady level of support, but he hasn't been able to break out of that. He hasn't collapsed, but he hasn't been able to break out. So you've got a vacuum that was ready to be filled, and here's Gingrich, who's an articulate guy, who filled it. The question is, where do we go from here? What happens to him? He's in the past been his own worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
He, as we pointed out last week, has flipped and flopped up there with the best of them, and he's got this very annoying arrogance, which creeps people out who get up close to him. And having said that, he's been out of government a long time. He's learned some things. If he can control his darker impulses, who knows?
Ralph.
Here's the issue. I think Romney's conservative credentials have been continually questioned, and he's being seen by the conservative base as being all things to all people, and they're perceiving Newt Gingrich as someone that's a serious thinker and who's been able to connect with this conservative base like no other Republican candidate. The other interesting thing that came up is Romney went to a restaurant in Colorado, and he was attempting to give a dollar bill to a young boy who was sort of in awe of him, and he wanted to impress. Well, what happened is he opened up his wallet, and he couldn't find any dollar bills. He didn't have anything less than a $100 bill. Now, that's not the kind of message you want to send when you're trying to win the Republican primary. You're showing that you're so detached from what's going on in this country. If you don't have anything in your wallet less than $100...
Well, I walk around from time to time. I don't have anything less than a 50.
But you're...
But
you're trying to appeal to this conservative working class base of people, and Romney is perceived as being all corporate. someone that is sort of detached from what regular America is going through. That's the perception among the conservative wing of the
Republican Party. He should have given the kid the $100.
Yeah, I would have given him the $100 and said, hey, kid, go invest this wisely.
Yeah.
Bob, the funny thing about this is when we talk amongst some of the insiders here inside the Beltway, they're just as shocked as we are around the table of Newt Gingrich's recent surge. And, you know, we'll talk about Herman Cain here in a second, but a lot of the votes that normally would have gone for Cain, it looks like that money train, that vote train is going to go and benefit possibly Newt Gingrich. Why is it that the people inside the Beltway are shocked, but the rest of the country is just going, this is what we wanted?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back, quite frankly, to the way the campaign has been run, being run this year. There are so many debates, and if there's one thing that the former speaker is very good at, as we all know, is he's very articulate. He has many ideas. He's well educated. He's very smart, and ideas pop out of his head. He can talk very, very persuasively. That is a wonderful ability to have when 90% of the campaign has become these almost biweekly debates over the last 2 months. And as other people have fallen by the wayside, either substantively or otherwise, he is always standing. He's always articulate. He's always agreeable. He does not attack other Republicans. He attacks the president. He's been a very smart and very able debater. And I think that's how 90% of the people who I believe feel he's a good potential candidate, that's all they know about him, because he has been a great debater.
That's the key thing. That's all they know about him.
Yeah.
There is much more to know about him that I think a lot of the Republican pros are going to be worried that should he get the nomination, that stuff will come pouring out, and then it'll be too late to do anything.
Well, let's talk about that.
It's bound to come out because it is very well known. It's almost all of it's documented.
Yeah.
His many changes of views. I mean, and I am not one of these people who thinks if you flip flop from one position to another over a period of 20 years, that somehow is wrong, because things change all the time. Look how many things used to be serious issues, which are now not so much serious issues. Things that were so important one time are not. Now there's new things that are coming up all the time. It's no wonder that people change their views. That's legitimate.
And Gingrich changed his views.
He's changed his views many more issues many more times than has Mr. Romney.
Right. Now, Alan, let's talk about the things that might come out about Newt. One of the things that happened here in the past few days here in Washington is Minority Leader's former Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, California, made a quote that she was going to talk about the thousands of pages of his stuff, unquote, referring to a 1990s era ethics investigation on the former Speaker. Is that a blind threat, or is this something that really the Gingrich campaign needs to be a little nervous about?
Well, I think that Mrs. Pelosi was not choosing her words very well when she basically made it appear as though secret information was going to be released. There was a huge public report that documented the charges and the penalties of him misusing funds and having to repay about $300,000. It was a huge black mark on him, and it was a long time ago. So he jumped back and said the whole she just proves that this whole ethics process is bankrupt and is not confidential. She hasn't broken any confidentialities yet.
It's a public document.
That's right. And now, having said that, she did say make reference to thousands of pages. And so, as I say, it was a stupid thing for her to say. She's got surrogates, you know, let people start calling attention to the press to go look at that document, go look at that document. The thing is, but Gingrich, he has changed his view on the individual mandate, on Medicare vouchers, on making Social Security private, on the issue of abortion rights. He's flip-flopped on infidelity. At the same time, he was trying to
talk about family values.
Impeach the president. He was having it on with his girlfriend on the side. I mean, he's got a boatload of stuff, which we will see. The question, I think, is whether we see it, when we see it, and how much his fellow Republicans bring it out, as opposed to kind of letting the press find it, or waiting, if should he get the nomination, God forbid, for the Democrats to just beat the hell out of him with it.
Well, by the way, before we go any further, I just want to say, if you want to join the conversation, you can dial in and call live and have a discussion with the roundtable at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Al, go ahead with your thoughts. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking that if the Democrats, as Barney Frank has suggested, should be happy that Newt Gingrich would be the nominee, I think the Republicans should be happy that Nancy Pelosi wants to carry that load. I mean, she is not one of the truly credible Democrats, in my judgment, with middle-of-the-road people.
But, Bob, go ahead.
Well, it strikes me that Al is exactly right. If I were a Republican and I'm see Nancy Pelosi on television on a news program saying, you know, that she thinks Newt Gingrich is not qualified, et cetera, and so forth, strikes me that I'm going to think more of Newt Gingrich.
Well, but you know, there's got to be the question, though, Alan, that the Romney campaign is looking at these poll numbers coming out of states like Iowa and South Carolina and even New Hampshire. Newt Gingrich is making some movement. But these are states that aren't the real telltale states. There hasn't been polling in places like Virginia. There hasn't been places in polling in places like Ohio, which are going to be key battleground states. Does Florida give the Romney campaign a little bit of pause? Is that something they should be fearful of at this stage?
They got to be paying a lot of attention all over the place to Gingrich right now. But the place that the key early test for Romney is New Hampshire. He lives in New Hampshire. He has got to win New Hampshire, and his support, although pretty high in the 40s in New Hampshire, is kind of frozen. And Newt's the one who's climbing. So that gets his attention. Iowa, Romney's not going to win Iowa.
Congressman Al.
Well, were you done?
Sorry.
I just thought this. If I were an advisor to Romney, I'd say, you have a chance here of a twofer. One, you get up and you say, I have been accused of a flip-flopping. The truth is, I have changed my position on some few issues, and add about two more sentences there. Then say, if you want to see a flip-flopper, and then I would just go after Gingrich, hammer and tong, because I think that way he can make Gingrich look like such an incredible flip-flopper that Romney, by comparison, is nothing, and he gets rid of that, or really reduces that vulnerability.
I'm afraid he's stuck with that.
Ralph,
if Gingrich can engage in a quick strike like winning Iowa, New Hampshire, which has tended to derail front runners, as well as Florida, Romney becomes very vulnerable. What you're finding now in the Republican Party, especially among the base, is they've become far more populist and working class, and many of these people feel that Romney is too tied to corporate interests, and they also want someone that's going to beat up Obama in a brawl. That came out in a quote, like Donald Trump. But Romney doesn't seem to have that ability to do that.
Well,
Gingrich seems to be the one that wants to really engage Obama on ideas and issues. And yes, Gingrich has a lot of flaws, but this conservative base doesn't seem to mind that so much.
Well, why is that, Bob? Why is it that the conservative base is actually appealing to somebody like a Newt Gingrich?
Well, I think because everybody else, number one, they don't see Romney as their kind of a candidate. And I'm not really sure why.
Is it the Mormon issue?
I don't think that's the issue, but I'm sure it has some impact on some people.
Is it the fact that he was a governor and a popular governor in a liberal state like Massachusetts?
Well, that can, of course, his health care bill did have a mandate in it, which you know, it used to be that that mandate was not an evil thing. It's turned out to be one in the last few years, but 25 years ago, there was a lot of thought in both parties that was the way to go.
Well, that's, that brings up a good question.
The reality is that as things have changed, Romney is on is not I guess I would say, intense enough.
Right.
On issues that the Tea Party type Republicans, the more conservative Republicans, and I don't use Tea Party in a pejorative sense.
Right.
I think their ideas about less government and keeping a balanced budget is a useful concept. We need that idea in the back of our heads all the time. Right. But the fact of the matter is, his evenness of a personality, his less than a dynamic personality, is hurting him. With some of the party, and Gingrich, with his ability to speak in very intense ways, is something that people have been drawn to as other conservative candidates have stumbled and fallen.
Let me hold on to that thought for a second. I want to come back to that, but Alan, I want to ask you. You know, we talk about the health care. You know, they talk about Obamacare. You know, the Romney health care plan in Massachusetts. Now Romney has come back and said that it was a solution that was right for my constituents in the Bay State, which is a valid argument. But we're also talking about something, you know, everybody against health care on the Republican side. It seems like the base has a short memory, because back in 72, when Nixon was seeking universal health care, it got widespread support from the Republican base back then. Is it that we just have a short memory about this, or is it that the times have changed?
Well, I'm not enough of a student of history to remember what was going on in 72. I think that there is a, as we saw in recent years, though, a huge conflict over what we should do about health care. We've had Republicans who proposed a mandate. Gingrich was one. John McCain was one at a particular point in time. Obama rejected an individual mandate. He wanted a
universal
care system.
Right.
It was Hillary Clinton who proposed the individual mandate. That ended up being the compromise. Romney said, let's try it, different things in different states. He's differentiated between doing something in Massachusetts, not proposing it nationally. Gingrich proposed it nationally. The fact of the matter is, our health system is a mess, continues to be a mess, will be a mess no matter what the Supreme Court decides on individual mandate. And that's not the only issue. There's no single one or two issues with Romney that are his problem. Some people don't like his religion. Some people don't like his perceived flip-flopping. Some people don't like what they perceive as a lack of authenticity and passion. There's all sorts of reasons, or they just feel like he's above them somehow. He's a 1%.
An elitist.
And so there's a lot of different reasons people don't like him, and there's a lot of reasons that people liked Michelle Bachmann for a while, Rick Perry for a while, Herman Cain for a while. Now they're turning to Gingrich. Are they going to stick with him? I don't know. That's the question.
Al, you know, it's funny, because when we talk about, you know, the country looking for a dynamic, eager, you know, gloves-off barroom brawler, this is the same electorate that voted for Obama in a majority vote that wanted somebody who was cool, calm, collected, and it seems like the tables have turned. Is it in fact that we're tired of, or that Obama is perceived as his coolness, his no drama Obama aspect is more of a deficit than it is a help in the presidential office?
I would argue that it is the conservative Republicans that want the barroom brawl. I don't think America wants a barroom brawl. I think they are sick and tired of all of this excuse me, the word just fled my mind. But it's a bunch of school kids, you know, slapping at each other. And I think they're tired of that, and they want somebody that would talk issues. So I think you've got a disconnect between what many Republicans want and what may be a better position going into the general election.
This is why Gingrich, if he became the Republican nominee, would lose the support of moderates and independents, which Romney was the nominee, he'd have a fighting chance to keep.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Bob, when we look at the bottom line here, and we look as we get closer to, we're now literally 45 days away, give or take, from our first major presidential primary in New Hampshire. We're starting to get down to brass tacks. Newt Gingrich has surged at a time when all the polling is starting to count, if you will. Can Newt Gingrich sustain this type of momentum into the key states like an early Florida, a middle term Virginia on what was once known as Super Tuesday, et cetera?
Well, one thing you have to remind yourself of is that Gingrich, at the moment, and I don't think this will continue necessarily, but at the moment it's almost a one-man band. He doesn't have a lot of troops on the ground in various early states that are organizing. Now, he's trying to do it in Iowa, and he's trying to do it in New Hampshire, because those are two very quick states. We're 30 days away from Iowa, and we're like 40 days or 35 days away from New Hampshire. So they're coming up soon, in early January. So the reality is, Gingrich may be able to sustain himself fundamentally on his oral presentations at the debates, but he also needs people on the ground who are encouraging his voters to get out. And he doesn't yet have that much of that. He's beginning to raise a good bit of money, so he's going to be able to have ads, but he still doesn't have troops, you know, and that usually you need troops on the ground to remind people to get to the polls and get to the caucuses.
Alan, I'm not even sure what kind of a money raising operation he's got yet. And he can put those together fairly quickly, although the best folks are already out there doing it. I was just seeing an article today that he's still got debt from all of the mistakes he made
early on,
way back in the beginning. He's got this. He's staffing up slowly. He lost a bunch of senior staff early on. This issue of staff loyalty, who's with you, how long do they stay with you? These are all issues that speak to how people close to a candidate feel about the candidate and suggest this whole undercurrent of challenges for this man who's the hot ticket of the moment.
Well, we're coming up in the last part of the segment. I want to go around. This is obviously media-driven, and my question now becomes, and I'll go to you, Congressman Ellis, being a former broadcaster, should the new Gingrich campaign have at its headquarters a shrine to the 24-hour news channels? Are they in large part responsible for bringing Newt Gingrich up to prominence? I mean, we see him, in particular, Fox News. He's no stranger to a camera on Fox News, but all three of them have been giving him coverage. Should he be thankful for a large media cycle for that?
Well, I think all of them in turn should be thankful to the media. Every one of the ones that rose with a lot of help on takeoff from the 24-hour news media. And then the news media, like they always like to do, they build you up and then they kick the shit out of you.
Family Channel. It's a family station now. Wow, Bob is now Bob's now lost the title of dropping the swear words.
I'm sorry to have taken it away from you.
just give me a chance at the mic.
Yeah.
So they do that. So I can't think of anybody, with the possible exception of Ron Paul, who has done it on his own. I mean, he's had a very steady thing, and the media doesn't talk about him at all. They dismiss him. And yet he's got numbers that deserve more attention than he's getting. But everybody else was boosted and then shot down with the media.
Alan, I go to you. What do you think?
I think that the extra number of debates, the constant proliferation of news channels has made a difference. It made a difference 4 years ago. It's making a bigger difference today. Who knows? Well, where we're headed, but you know something, the ground rules change. You have to adjust. You ask the people, you ask the Bachmans, Perrys, and Keynes how they feel about it. It made them, and it broke them.
Mm-hmm.
And now it has not made Romney, and it didn't break Romney. The question is, what about Newt? It helped make him
will it also contribute to breaking him? And there's a lot of attention now turning to him. These other guys are out of the picture. And I say, watch out, Newt, because your record is going to be fly specs.
Will Nancy Pelosi have a chance to go to that stuff before the media does?
Yes.
You know? Good point. Bob, what do you think?
I think that Gingrich is in the following situation. His record is going to be suddenly going to be the issue of the day for the next few weeks, number one. Number two, he's got to raise some money. And number three, he's got to get some troops on the ground in the early primaries. And those last two items are things he has to do. The first item there about his dealing with his record, he's going to have to explain how he has, we're worried about being a flip-flopper if we're a conservative, how he is more of a flip-flopper than anyone else who is now a serious candidate.
And well, that begs the question, if the media is his best friend now, is the media going to be the one that takes him down?
The media isn't anybody's friend. They pick you up and they throw you down. They're not looking for friends. They're looking
they like
for stories.
They like change, and so if you're up, the way to get some change is take somebody down.
Yeah. Right. Ralph,
I think this 24-hour news cycle is really going to continue to help Gingrich push his agenda and show some passion and fight. But at the same time, as I agree with everyone, his whole record is going to be scrutinized, and it's going to be interesting to see if they're going to draw his wife into this, because she has come under some initial criticism because of her lavish spending and her constant meddling in the campaign, and that's what drove his numbers down initially.
But one thing you have to say, of all of them, Gingrich is the best one at giving it to the media.
Absolutely.
When they criticize him, he just says, he fires right back at them. That's usually a dangerous thing to do. And it may prove to be a dangerous thing for him to do, but right now he's getting away with it. It's certainly better than any of the other candidates.
It'll help him with the base.
He uses them and he abuses them.
Well, as we're speaking right now, Governor Romney is taking questions in Arizona, and I don't know if this is a big deal, but we'll say it. CNN is reporting that Mitt Romney just got the endorsement of ex-Vice President Dan Quayle, which probably might get him a couple of bucks and maybe a six-pack of beer.
I think more interesting just in this report is that Romney made a decision. He will not appear on the Donald Trump-moderated debate in Iowa. He was the last one to decide. Huntsman and Paul said, no way. Gingrich said, okay. And then Bauman and Santorum said, okay. Romney was the big question mark, and he has said,
absolutely
no.
Not.
It's hard for me to understand why guys would want to share the podium with a so-called moderator who is keeping his options open to jump into the race. It's the craziest thing going, but That's Donald Trump.
It's just one more crazy thing that we're having in the Republican Party.
I don't even believe that we're even mentioning the name Donald Trump at this point, but we'll talk about that later. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Occupy movement. Some things have happened in the past couple of weeks. Lots of interactions, clashes between police and the Occupy movement. They were cleared out of New York, cleared out of Philadelphia, San Francisco, London. They just had an interaction with police this weekend here in Washington, D.C. Are they done? We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
Of the sun and west of the moon. only way, dear. Living on love until moonlight. Just you and I. Forever and a day. Love will not die.
Here at Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. By the way, if you're in the Washington area, come by Chili's this afternoon around 6 o'clock. Chili's is having a bourbon tasting and cigar pairing courtesy of Maker's Mark. Good way to test out the latest brands coming out of the Maker's Mark cabinet. Should be good stuff. Good sign. Goes from 6 till 10. And it'll be in the bourbon room of Shelly's Back Room. So come on down if you get a chance, and we'd love to meet you. We're going to talk a little bit right now about what's going on with the Occupy movement. A lot of developments happened while we were away a couple of weeks ago. Namely, the city of New York decided for health reasons to clear the Occupy Wall Street crowd out of the park down on Lower Manhattan, which created a storm of conflict between New York police and the Occupy movement. Just this past weekend, the park police tore down a wood structure over in McPherson Square, which, for those of you who are not familiar with Washington, D.C., is at a key intersection right there on K Street in the heart of lobbying Mecca. Park police had some conflict, made several arrests, but did not clear them out, which was the thought was going to happen. But we've also seen them get cleared out of areas in San Francisco, London, England. Philadelphia had a little bit of a raucous.
Oakland
had a big raucous. We saw the raucous on what happened at the University of California in Berkeley. University of California, Davis, rather. Thank you, Alan. The question now becomes is, is the Occupy movement over, Al?
I don't know. It got started wrong. It never had any leadership. It couldn't focus on one or two issues so that you could drive those home. They had them, but they talked about everything from environment to banks to what have you, and completely splayed out their message. They used tactics which the general public usually finds slightly, if not more than that, obnoxious. So it seems to me that they blew a great chance to take one of the major issues in this campaign, namely what the banks got away with in our financial decline, and blew it. So I don't know whether they're done or not, but they might as well be, because I think they're done having any positive effect on the election.
Al,
they need leadership. It was a ragtag group of people.
They need you out there carrying the flag, leading them. Because they were all over the lot. We've known that from the beginning. Some mad at the banks, some mad at income disparity, some mad that as college students with big debts they had to pay their loans back, some mad about the environment. It was and continues to be just this really odd collection. Very American, very interesting, very ineffective, all but dead, but not quite.
Bob?
I'm seeing the image of Al, cigar in hand, sleeping in the tent while it's raining. It's hard to vision this.
He's a Washington State guy.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, come on, yo. Kim, you know, oh, please. San Juan Island. I've spent many times
there. He knows how to keep a cigar going in the rain.
Exactly.
Here's what I, you know, my view
I'll
is...
I'll tell you this. I do know how they could have made this a more effective thing. They didn't ask me. I was too bashful to offer.
I don't see it as it was ever a movement. I've always seen it as a scrum. The sense that they had 20 different ideas. They never decided what they were after and what they wanted. We've all said it. It's reality.
But Ralph,
you had a criminal element sort of infiltrate the movement, and there were drug overdoses, stabbings, fights, and. With no leadership in the movement as to what issues they were really wanting to promote, it's just sort of degenerated into nothing. And people are becoming fed up, and they want them removed. They've been there for a long period of time, and people are saying, what gives them the right to take over a public place for an unlimited amount of time?
But now, when you look, I mean, obviously the country wanted a anti-Tea Party movement for the other side. The Occupy movement stood to be that movement and had some momentum going. And I'll go to Al here in a second. But, Alan, was it truly something that the country wanted, or was it just happened to be the knee-jerk reaction for the left?
I don't think that the country necessarily wanted a movement. There's a lot of anger out there. There was certainly the potential for some coalescing. It never happened. You didn't have the sort of local, powerful, small community groups, small organizing groups come together that sort of was what became of the Tea Party. The Tea Party wasn't a single national movement. It was hundreds of smaller movements. This was a handful of groups who weren't united on any particular objective, and they had no leadership. And were not about to give up any control to self-proclaimed leaders.
Well, now there's an estimated 3,000 people that are making their way up to Capitol Hill. I can tell you, being out on Capitol Hill last night, saw a bunch of them roaming the streets of Pennsylvania Avenue by the Capitol building on the House side. 3,000 people, the House members are refusing visits from these members of Congress. Is that a smart move, Bob, or should they actually say, look, I got 9%, I might as well listen to everybody?
Well, I suppose if some of them were in, if I were a member and somebody was from my district, I'd see them. But just to see a bunch of people walk into my office, say, I want to see you, and I have no idea who they are, and they're not from my area, I don't see why I'd want to particularly see them. I mean, obviously, if a group came in, I can't imagine they'd only have one thing. They'd only have one point of view. They'd have about half a dozen points of view.
Al, you're a former member of Congress. If these occupiers had come into your office, would you have given them a visit?
I had people come in and were going to do sit-ins in my district office and what have you. And our whole approach was come and sit. At 5 o'clock, the federal building closed. We said, we're not going to throw you out. We should warn you. The federal marshal will come and throw you out. And I almost got, there's a wonderful story going on, but I won't go into that. I think what I would have done here is I would have said, okay, pick three people out of this, and I will meet for a half hour with whatever three people you want. And I would have sat down with them and had tried to have as civil an exchange as possible, and then say, that's it. but I wouldn't have thrown them out of the office. That's what they want.
Yeah. If you look at the Lyndon LaRouche supporters, they consistently come on Capitol Hill, and they're perceived as just rabble-rousers, troublemakers. They may have ideas, but the way they go and try and present their ideas to force them onto other people and just rubs people the wrong way. And then even if they may have good, noble objectives, people don't see it that way. They just perceive them as troublemakers.
When you look at the Occupy movement and what could have been, could they have been a successful influence in the upcoming election, both congressionally and in the presidential
election?
I
think the issue could have been handled properly, could have been dynamite.
Yeah.
That is, the banks and all of that. But, as Alan has said twice, there was no leadership. They couldn't decide what their message was. And hence, anybody heard was noise.
Right. Well, Alan, you know, the funny thing about this movement on Capitol Hill this week, which is different from the other ones, is you now have labor coming in, most notably the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, which has been a very far-left liberal labor union as opposed to some of the more moderate ones like the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the Pipefitters, etc. SEIU is now backing the Occupy movement on Capitol Hill. Is this a last-ditch effort to keep Occupy alive and keep them relevant, or is this something now that the labor unions, particularly like the SEIUs and the AFT, may jump on board with and say, now we've got the right approach? Could they be the leaders of an Occupy movement?
It's conceivable. I think they see, as Al does, that there's some potential here. There's some issues that might generate some enthusiasm and some heat, and they've got the wherewithal to provide some infrastructure, some guidance. They got to be really careful though, because this is a group that from all indications doesn't want to be led, doesn't agree on things, isn't good about following stuff, lots of individual agendas. I think the SEIU, my guess is, they thought, well, let's just give it a try. Let's see if we can coalesce something. And if not, nothing ventured, nothing gained, but no real downside to us. That's my hunch, but I don't know.
Does it make sense? I mean, is it in the interest of the SEIU maybe to get involved in something like Occupy, Congressman Al?
If they could be successful at getting it focused and provide some leadership, yes. I doubt that they would be accepted. But the big problem is these people don't want to be led. Everybody wants to be the chief. And I've often said that one of the problems that Washington, D.C. has perennially is not lack of leadership, it's lack of followership.
Right. But, Bob, it almost strikes me, going on off of what Al was saying, is, you know, the Occupy movement here in D.C. reminds us a lot of the anarchist movements that we see every couple of years when the IMF and the World Bank meets here in Washington. A bunch of people in ski masks walking around throwing rocks, camping out, all kinds of the sort, and all of a sudden, you know, they go away. But this one has sustainability. I guess the question now becomes is what's going to separate the Occupy movement here in Washington versus the anarchist movement during those type of meetings? And is it worth the time to give these people and the movement itself the time of day?
Look, they're American citizens. They're not violent for the most part. They're camped out. It's going to get cold. It's going to be difficult. And if they want to stay there, I expect they'll be able to stay until they start causing trouble.
Well, they've already caused trouble. I mean, we bring up the UC Davis issue. You know, well, everybody saw what happened at UC Davis. Quite frankly, in my view, I don't fault the police for taking the action that they did.
Well, I don't there either. I'm talking about here in D.C.
Oh, here, okay. I'm sorry.
Wait a minute. The police pepper sprayed a bunch of students sitting there. You don't do that. If you want to move them, you arrest them and you take them out.
That's right.
You don't fill their bodies with chemicals. Yeah. That was a huge mistake.
That was about as dumb a thing as you could do. I couldn't disagree more. I can tell you right now, from being a law enforcement officer on a campus, you know, looking at the videotape, and we just saw the one shot, the one soundbite of the officer just sprang like he was spraying for cockroaches. The reality is that if you look, and there's video out there of a timeline that shows that literally the police told these students, look, move, we want to leave in an orderly fashion. The students blocked their path of egress. They did not obey a lawful order, which in most states in the country is illegal and arrestable. They did not. They were told they taunted police. They taunted police this weekend. I don't fall. In fact, I would venture to say that if I were UC Davis police, campus police, I think they actually showed quite a bit of restraint, giving these people over an hour's worth of notice to disperse, at least give us away. We're not going to throw you out of the park. Just let us leave in an orderly fashion. And they refused.
I just don't think you turn to the chemicals. I think
I don't
you,
either.
I think you start arresting them one by one, hauling them out.
All
it's a pain, but that's what you do.
I think that, and I think the police needed to focus on why they were doing this, and just saying that they're doing an illegal something or other. Was it hurting anything?
I would have
pretty stiff-necked sometimes.
If it would have been me there, I would have thought the best thing for the police to do, two policemen walk over to one guy or one gal, pick them up, put the cuffs on them, put them in the paddy wagon.
They tried that, and they did it.
All you got to do is pick one up and take one, and then take the next one, and the next one, and pretty soon
that's
stop.
What they do around the White House.
Yeah.
That's what you do most places.
Right.
And, and you don't see somebody walking around spraying roaches. Or what looks like spraying roaches.
The image of police officers using pepper spray on people who are, quote, nonviolent at that time. The pictures are not good.
I honestly believe, and I'm taking off my moderator hat, which I rarely do, but, this
put
is...
Put it back on, Justin.
Wow. I've struck a nerve.
We made pepper spray you.
Now it's acceptable. Funny thing. I will tell you right now, I have experienced tear gas. You have to. In order to carry as a law enforcement officer, I've been tear gas. But the reality is, when somebody disobeys a lawful order, and they did it this weekend, when you were told, and Park Police has shown a tremendous amount of patience with these people.
I agree.
They have allowed them to stay where they are. When they say, the only thing you cannot do, you can pitch tents all through McPherson Square. We don't care. Get porta potties and don't put up any permanent structures. When you start building a single-story house, what amounts to a single-story house in McPherson Square, that brings into question, you are not obeying a lawful order. And you take away, and I think that the students at UC Davis did the same thing. They failed to obey a lawful order. And the police followed the use of force continuum. They warned them numerous times. And at some point, the police are going to have to show their law. They use non-lethal weapons. They use non-lethal use of force. And unfortunately,
Sheriff Justin, what about fire hoses?
Fire hoses would have been appropriate. I'm sorry.
There weren't that many people. You arrested them.
They arrested numerous people.
I remember the bottom line is the media is starting to lose interest in them, and they're not getting the press coverage that they once had. And they're looking for ways to get the media back, media spotlight. And one of the ways is to engage and attack with the police.
I make no bones about it. I'm very pro law enforcement. Being one myself, I know how tough that job is. I disagree. But Al, you had a comment. You want to
go back to Kent State Week? There were towns with universities and colleges in it all over this country that were close to exploding.
Yes.
And in my little town of Bellingham, Washington, the home of Western Washington University, the same thing was going on. And the students wanted to march down from the college and meet at an intersection where the federal building was and hold a rally. the mayor said, you need 3 days to get a parade permit. I'm not going to let you do it. Well, two things started to happen. A bunch of ministers in town went down and grabbed the mayor by the throat and shook him until he got some brains and he withdrew. While that was going on, the radicals that had been running the thing up on the college somehow got replaced by moderates, and they had the march. It was peaceful. They had a rally, a whole bunch of speeches, and they went away. No one was hurt. Nothing was damaged. And yet, it was this same mayor who once, when some hippies wanted to make a garden out of a piece of property that belonged, a private property, he sent the police over in riot gear on buses, and they ended up breaking arms and doing all kinds of things. Now, the idea of growing a garden on that corner was idiotic and stupid and foolish, and it wouldn't have hurt anything to let them just do it. But instead, we now riot police.
But if you see what happened at UC Davis, when the police said, we're about to leave, please clear this pathway, they started yelling at the police, let our friends go and we'll let you leave. You don't let the police leave. The police should have egress, and they gave them an order to disperse out of that little pathway. At what time does this become anarchy?
You arrest them one by one, pick them up, put the cuffs on them, and put them in a paddy wagon. Yeah. Go get another one and do the same thing
and
to
don't
them.
Don't let a bunch of pimply-faced kids get your macho up so that you feel that you have been insulted.
I don't think it was a matter of insulting.
And don't do something that when it goes on the camera, it's going to make you look bad. It's going to make the police officers. The peace officers who we're supposed to respect, we want our kids to respect the police, and then they do things like that, and the kids see it.
I'm guessing, Justin is the one who has served in this capacity, and I think none of us sort of understand some of the pressure you're under on the one hand. On the other hand, there have to be rules of engagement. When do you pull your pepper spray? And what happened out at UC Davis is that the public was not prepared for cops to pull out pepper spray and spray it on a bunch of people sitting down. That's the killer image.
It's a perception. I agree. Perception is bad. Yeah. I agree that the perception is bad. But before we vilify law enforcement, there is an absolute use of force continuum. You give them a lawful order. If they fail to obey, you attempt to arrest them. If they resist arrest, which they did, when you resist arrest, you have to use the minimum force necessary to compel compliance. They, in that instance, I believe, looking at all the video that I have seen, that police department used the necessary use of force necessary to compel compliance. It worked. It was the last thing. I mean, we're not going to go – we will never see another Kent State. I guarantee you we will never see another Kent State where National Guard troops are using lethal force to disperse what seems to be peaceful crowd on a college campus. But at some point, there has to be repercussions for protesters not to obey the lawful order of a police department and a police officer.
None of us have ever seen this or heard of this occurring before. Pepper spray to a large group, and my guess is that whatever the protocol is for police forces around the country, they're reassessing them in light of the disaster. The disaster.
The perceived disaster. That is a perception.
It doesn't matter. It's still a disaster. The perception is reality here. It was a disaster. You ask those police forces and the president of the University of California, Davis, whether they think they're changing their policy. I'm sure police forces all over the country are reviewing their policies in light of the disaster, because it's all about perception. It was a disaster for them. Whether it was fair, reasonable, should have been, doesn't matter. It was a disaster.
You look at a large police department like New York City, NYPD, everybody said, oh my God, NYPD is just another army coming in and just tearing up tearing up peaceful protesters. The NYPD had to use pepper spray on protesters down in Wall Street. They failed to obey, and I'll tell you right now, the folks in NYPD have less patience for failure to obey a lawful order than UC Davis police do.
Al, I think, could you pick up his moderator hat? It's over on the floor.
You know what? It's happy hour. I'm going to end it right now. Go ahead, Al. I'll give you the last word.
All I was going to say was exactly that. Put the moderator's hat back on because I don't hear us getting any closer than we were when we started. We will not resolve this issue around the table.
I was almost prepared to get some pepper spray.
And by the way, the only reason why I'm stopping this is because it's happy hour. It's time for us to order drinks.
All right.
It's 5 o'clock here on the East Coast. It's happy hour here at Chili's Back Room. We're going to order drinks, get some new cigars, and we will be back in 3 minutes. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about international politics. We're going to talk about the EU meeting that's going on this week, and is it too little too late? Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
That's as...
Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And yet,
are you
still
going to arrest us now?
Wow. Ow. I just put the moderator back on. I can take that puppy off. I'll show you disobeying a lawful order.
I got pepper shake.
Oh, my God.
Talk about something else that I can moderate without getting so impassioned about. This week, it was announced that President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, and the Chancellor of the German government, Chancellor Angela Merkel, are meeting privately before going to a full EU finance meeting that's happening later this week to help stave off disaster in the European economy. All kinds of problems still occurring. There's a lack of confidence in the European markets. The European markets have just taken nosedives recently. Contrary, the stock market here in the U.S., Wall Street's been fairly stable when it comes to that. But when we look at what's happening between France and Germany, Ralph, is this too little too late?
I think they're getting down to the deadline. As we know, Angela Merkel struggling to help fund the rest of the Eurozone, and it could have a disastrous impact on her political career because people in Germany are getting fed up with having to pay for the debts of other countries. Already you've seen a change in government in Italy. I think putting a new Italian foreign minister in place is a very good sign. But I think it's going to come down to someone else having to come in and help Europe. It could be the Chinese after the Chinese New Year. If the situation is still as unstable as it is, you could see the Chinese feeling that they're going to have to come in and help bail out the Eurozone, but at a heavy price to the Europeans. The fact of the matter is if Europe falls apart, you have to look at the impact on American imports and exports, as well as the banks and the financial markets in the U.S., which is why Geithner has gone to Europe and he's this week, and he's trying to talk tough with Merkel and Sarkozy. So it's going to be very interesting to see what comes of that.
And by the way, we invite anybody listening out there in Radio Land, you can join the conversation at 619-638-8477. That is 619-638-8477. Ralph, staying with you, it seems like this is a two-horse race between Merkel and Sarkozy. We haven't seen a lot coming in from number 10 Downing Street. Obviously, the Greeks and the Italians, folks in Athens and Rome, have been very dormant as far as making efforts to try and fix this. We haven't seen a lot of Spain and Portugal, which could be the next two to fall. What is the breaking point right now in the European economy? Will we see the disbanding of the euro? Will they go back to individual monetary currencies in each of the sovereign nations?
It's certainly looking like that. A lot of analysts have felt it was very unrealistic to have one currency for all these different countries that have different ideas and perceptions on how you are supposed to manage money. I think the Greek situation has really become a horrible issue. As we've said before, the Greeks may end up just having to pull out of the Eurozone because I think the other countries are feeling they're just a dead weight. And if they're dropped, maybe that is a way to save the rest of the other countries.
When we saw the G20, which you attended, and when we saw some of the results of that, but it just seemed that there wasn't really any hardcore solutions coming out of that meeting. Who's to blame for that?
I think it's, all the EU countries can be blamed. There really is not one leader that has sort of stepped up. I mean, yes, you have Merkel and you have Sarkozy, but nobody really wants to do the right thing and to make massive cuts in government that is going to be needed to bring those countries into line.
Bob, is there almost a little bit of blame to go with the United States and in particular President Obama for showing a lack of leadership in dealing with the global economic downturn?
Well, I'm not sure that that's the case. I know about as much about economics as I do about the dark side of the moon. But it seems to me that we have tried to be helpful. I know that the Secretary of the Treasury has been over there talking to everybody and trying to encourage them to find a solution. My impression is that. And Ralph, you probably know this better than I do, but I saw something in the paper, I guess on Sunday, there was a timetable this week for what was going to be the Chancellor and the President of France and Germany were meeting on Monday. I gather that today the Greek Parliament is voting on their austerity program. I believe tomorrow the Italian Parliament is voting on their austerity program. And so we get toward the later in the week and then all the whole group gets together and tries to find a solution, and I gather the French president and the chancellor have come up with something that is beyond what they have been willing to agree to in the past. So, I mean, I suppose they're doing the best they can do over there, but, you know, as far as what we can do, I don't think we can do much more than try to be helpful.
It's interesting because the new Italian foreign minister, Giulio Terzi di Santa Gatta, a friend of mine here in D.C., was the Italian ambassador here. And he had very strong relations with the U.S. And it's going to be very interesting to see if he can wield some of those strong connections and personal relationships and helping to bring Italy closer to the U.S. and in developing solutions to the crisis.
Right. Alan, it seems that, you know, we're looking at the political outfall. You know, we've seen two heads of states fall, Greece and Italy. We're seeing some of the ripple effect of that maneuvering. We're seeing the ripple effect in this emergency meeting of the EU and the finance chairs. Is there a political ripple effect that could cross the Atlantic and start hitting us that we've got to take notice of what's going to come out of this meeting this week?
It's the fact that there are economic effects that can affect us that can become political. There's no domino effect of politicians falling over there, but they're falling over there because of this horrendous economic situation that they got themselves into, arguably, when they created the Eurozone, and then in the last 4 years with the creatoring of the world economy. Give you one example about Greece. The last thing Greece wants to do is to drop out of the Eurozone. Right now, they're propped up or have the potential to be propped up. The moment they go on their own, you have massive inflation, horrendous loss of savings, and loss of interest in foreign investment. But because there's fear of that, the citizenry of Greece is beginning to take actions which may make this a self-fulfilling prophecy. In the last 2 years, deposits in Greek banks have dropped 30% because people, not just rich people, average people, are yanking their savings out, getting their euros out, because they're so afraid that if they lose the ability to get euros, they're going to get some kind of Greek currency that will be inflated. Their unemployment rate is over 18% in Greece. They are just skittering along the edge, and the citizenry is acting out of self-interest, and that's exacerbating the problem.
Right. I think if the Greek people don't agree to the bailout package, I think they're going to see increased pressure on the part of the other members of the Eurozone to kind of push Greece out because they feel that the Greeks are dragging them down.
Are the Greeks at a point right now where we could see, like we saw in Turkey back in the late 60s, early 70s, people paying, you know, wheelbarrows full of paper currency to buy a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk? Is that possible in Greece?
Absolutely, I think, especially if they have to leave the Eurozone.
What about Italy?
I don't think so, because the Italians have a new government, and I think the people are rallying around the new administration.
Was it smart for them to put in an economic wonk versus a political player in replacing Berlusconi?
I think certainly economics to play the key role here, and I think you have much more support among the Italian people for making the necessary changes that is going to be needed to save the country from going into bankruptcy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's hard to know where the Italian people are on all of this. Among other things, the Italians have historically taken great pride in not paying taxes. It's just endemic. You cheat on your taxes.
Right.
So it's hard to say to the public, okay, everybody, ante up.
Yeah.
In this time of these difficult times, what may help in Italy and in Spain and Portugal is if Greece should get pushed out of the Eurozone and have massive inflation, horrible disruption, that will get the attention of the Italians and the Spanish and the Portuguese in a whole new way, and they might think, oh my God, that we don't want. We're going to have to swallow hard and take this bitter medicine, but that's better than going the way of Greece.
But it sounds like to me that, you know, if it does go that way, I mean, you know, number one, in Italy, we're dealing with the third largest economy in the Eurozone today. You know, you can't let your number three economic power just all of a sudden drop and you know, do push-ups. That's bad. The reality is, you know, when we look at Greece, actually more of a question is, when we look at Greece, is there more of a need for the IMF to take a stronger role in coming up with a bailout solution instead of leaving it to the EU, or is this an EU sovereignty question?
Well, that, and that's something that's it's very tricky. I think that the Greeks really, they want to be supported by financial institutions, but at the same time, they want to maintain this sort of independence. And they don't see why they should have to cut back on things that they feel are owed to them, this cradle-to-grave coverage. But they're going to have to massively cut government in order for that country to survive.
You know, Bob, we look at what happened in Greece. We look at what happened in Italy. And these are both very much entitlement-based states. We look at the entitlement arguments that are going on here in Washington. Does it appear, some inside the Beltway, that what we're seeing in Greece and Italy could possibly happen here in the U.S.?
I can't imagine that. No. I can't imagine us having our people, our citizens, work harder than most of the people in Europe. They work longer hours. The economy is a we're much more willing to work 40 hours a week. What the French? I think the French have a 35-hour week.
Right.
I think the Italians have no more than that. Their benefits are greater. The Greeks retired 50, as I recall.
Right, correct.
I mean, it's just, the whole reality in Europe is it's a different culture than we have. Now, that makes it very nice to sit in bistros in Champs-Élysées or sitting in a nice little Italian trattoria someplace in the hill country, but we're not that kind of a people. I think we're a little more...
We sit around cigar bars.
And my guess is that it couldn't happen here because, no matter how bad it gets, other places, I mean, as bad as it gets here, I don't think it's going to get there. We're not going to be that way because we have a better structure of government. We're a stronger government than most countries have, a more stable government. And I don't think people are willing to, as much as other countries are willing to see the whole thing fall apart as long as they get theirs.
Yeah. I don't totally disagree with Bob, but I keep thinking that democracy is great when you're giving things away.
Yeah.
Democracy gets tough when you start taking things away. And we have so far not dealt very well with our problems of what you're going to take away, who you're going to charge, how you're going to get rid of it. And I think we're in for a very rough period. I don't think we're going to end up like Greece.
No.
But we're going to have our own problem.
Yeah,
but
we may
benefit from watching Greece.
Exactly.
Because that allows people here to say, folks, start talking, start making hard decisions, because we are not that different from the countries in Europe. It doesn't have to be Greece. These countries in Europe that are teetering on the edge, an aging population, high unemployment, high social spending, and inadequate revenue. And we don't want to go the way of them, but we're on a path in that direction.
I totally agree. And, I hate to throw Greece under the bus, but
go ahead. Why not?
But somebody getting thrown under the bus could be very beneficial in terms of public opinion.
Well, and remind ourselves of this. Just to use something we've gone back to time and time again in the last year. The Bowles-Simpson Commission report is about as fine a starting place as anybody could look to. Both parties, the most conservative, the most liberal, both parties find a lot of good in at least half of the approach they're taking. The conservatives like the kinds of talk they had about cutting back on the need to cut back on our overly expensive entitlements. The Democrats like some of the ideas they had about raising revenues. Now, we're going to be, that's a foundation that we've got, that the politicians have created themselves, and fundamentally, it's probably as good a foundation. One of these days, we're going to find ourselves with enough people in the center to pull the two extremes a little bit closer together, and then we're going to start finding ways to solve our problems. Everybody knows we've got to do it. Today we are, in the next week or so, we are going to be approving an extension of the unemployment tax reduction. The employment, you know, the Social Security, the
payroll
money,
tax. Payroll tax.
Correct.
Yes, payroll tax. Right.
Now, the payroll tax, I mean, nobody says a word about it, but the payroll tax goes one place. It goes to pay for Social Security.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the point is, we are taking money out of that fund, in effect, in the billions of dollars. Every year we have this holiday on some of the taxes. Nobody's talking about it, but it's a reality. And it's going to cause us a little bit more angst, and we're going to have to move a little more early to get a solution. And I think that may be something that we're going to find is we will be able to it will get us a little bit more of a pressure on us to find a solution to the problem.
But, Bob, you know, Bob brings up...
I'm an optimist.
And you are an optimist on the Super Committee, which leads me to my next question to Congressman Al. You know, we hear what Bob's saying. We hear about Bob talking about Simpson Bowles. We should have instituted it. There should have been leadership enough to bring it to fruition.
Right.
We failed in that. The Super Committee failed. We've seen what's been happening in Europe, particularly with Greece and the surprise in Italy. When we saw that, wouldn't that have been shouldn't that have been a wake-up call to the Super Committee to say, okay, now we've really got to sit down and put brass tacks down?
It should have had that effect on the whole Congress.
And why didn't it?
Well, first of all, the Tea Party came probably at a very bad time to force us to dig our heels in on the tax aspect of it and force the Republicans to dig their heels in on that part. You still have the Democrats who are not showing any signs of being willing to talk about reform of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And there's got to be some reform. It doesn't mean we're going to shove Grandma off a cliff. In fact, it probably won't affect Grandma at all. It's more likely to affect son and daughter, that you have down the line, but they'll have years to prepare for it. You just don't see the give from either side that you need in order to resolve the problem.
Now, haven't the Democrats seized on an issue about the payroll tax cut in terms of trying to provide a tax cut for the middle class?
Yes, they certainly have. And I think I think it was Allen who said, you know, fine and good, but you're taking money out of some of these funds, the Social Security Fund and what have you, in order to
Bob
do
was
it.
Bob just reiterating
right.
that point.
Bob, okay, I'm sorry, I was out getting...
The one thing, though, that it does beg the question, you know, you have these mass protests in Athens. We haven't seen the protests in Italy yet. But when we look at what happened in Athens, what Athens does not have is strong special interest groups like AARP, like Americans for Tax Reform.
Yeah, you know what Athens has? 40% of the people who are on the government payroll.
Yeah,
that's what they've got.
But
that dwarfs
and the government just collapses. AARP or anything else. When there's street protests, the government just
stops. Right, but when we look at the special interest, I mean, because literally when we were talking about some of the same austerity measures in the Super Committee, in Bull Simpson, or any of the commission deals that we were looking at, we start looking at some of the civil rights call to action that we saw with the AARP put out millions of dollars of ads that were apparently effective in swinging Congress and the Super Committee to maybe review how that looks.
I don't know how much the ads had anything to do with anything. I think that part there was a whole other dynamic going on here that there was a lot of Chicken Little, the sky is falling rhetoric out there. We need to, the Super Committee has to act. Super Committee has to act. We got to get this stuff done. If we don't, the economy is going to collapse. Inflation is going to go through the roof. We're not going to be able to borrow finance all of these government programs that we're not willing to collect taxes on. And as we got closer and closer to failure, the market didn't go to hell. money is still flooding into America, in part because nobody wants to put money in Europe, given their bigger problems. So a lot of the big concerns about return of inflation and nobody buying treasury bonds, we could see in advance wasn't going to happen. And then the dynamic inside the super committee was such that we know what the two sides were, and then there was this big looming thing of the Bush tax cuts scheduled to expire a year from now, and the Republicans said, we're not going to do a tax thing now and not make that part of it. Now, they wanted to make that part of it in a pretty aggressive way, and the Democrats said, we're not doing that. We want to raise taxes now and raise them again a year from now, and the Republicans said, nope. And there was no big price to pay for either one other than people saying, disaster, couldn't get it done, horrible. But financially speaking, there was no big price to pay.
Ralph, when we look at what's happening in Europe, the one country that we've seen who's been able to implement austerity measures and have it be a jagged pill, but they swallow it anyway, is England.
Right.
David Cameron's done a great job in getting austerity measures put into place. He's gotten a coalition parliament behind it. When we see David Cameron's been awfully quiet during the G20 and during recent events that's happened in Europe. Is there a lesson to be learned off of what's happened in England that not only Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal could learn, but also what the Americans can learn too?
We've got to watch and see if it's going to affect him politically, if he gets kicked out of office because of these austerity measures.
Is there talk of a vote of no confidence in Parliament?
It's always a possibility if people are really opposed to what you're promoting, and that's what Angela Merkel is concerned about, her political career.
Is her political career in danger as a result of this?
If they bail out the Eurozone and it means more, if it means that the German people have to absorb more of the cost. They're getting very angry about it.
Now,
are you aware at all of any polling taking place in Great Britain that indicates how people are reacting to the austerity program?
I don't have any polling info right now,
I think the government.
I agree with Ralph.
Right.
That the government is under the gun here because these austerity programs harm people, and one of the aspects of English society that or British society that's really taking it on the chin. Nobody's probably going to talk about. In 2000, the royal family used to get $120 million a year, and they've been cut back to $49 million a year, imagine.
Yeah. Right. Well, I can say right now.
And they're going to have to fund the Olympics.
It's tough to be a queen.
Yeah. The crown has got some pressure. No, but I will tell you right now. Is that
an Andy Gay remark?
Ow! Ow!
You will
see. I'm shocked.
You will see Cameron's austerity measures really come to the forefront, depending on what happens with the Olympics in London. Already, there are costs. There's talk of the fact that there could be some issues with how it's funded. Are they going to go into bankruptcy?
Okay. Well, we're going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Iran and what's going on over there. That's something that's gotten everybody a little bit on edge here in Washington. In particular, it's got London and Paris on edge quite a bit. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Thank you.
da down, da da down, 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 down.
And we're back here live in Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Coming into the home stretch, we want to talk a little bit about some international stress being caused by activities in Tehran. Last week we talked a little bit about what was happening where Islamic fundamentalist students basically made a raid on the British embassy in Tehran. Bottom line is it looked a lot like 1979 Tehran back under the Ayatollah Khomeini. It caused Great Britain to close the embassy in Tehran, leave a skeleton crew at the embassy. But it was based on the fact that the British government and David Cameron put in some pretty staunch sanctions against the Iranian government in the way that the British government also deals with them. Paris and Berlin have also done the same kind of sanctions against Tehran, but they're now nervous that it's going to cause another uprising. The question is now, does this strike you as, are we going to see another 1979 Iran again? Are we starting to see the pro-democracy movement being pushed out by the true Islamic fundamentals? Are we going to see another U.S. embassy, British embassy type situation again? Bob, what do you think?
Well, I don't think it's it's not Tehran's benefit to do something like that. They've got internal struggles that are rather severe. The head Ayatollah who runs the place, Khamenei,
mm-hmm.
and the president, are at odds, serious at odds, about, you know, I mean, obviously we know who the final authority is, but he is taking more and more, he's getting more and more dissatisfied with what the president is doing. And the president is being more and more isolated. So I think we have to be concerned, because anytime the power structure of a country gets discombobulated, gets upset, has an internal struggle, it becomes possible to do some things in the foreign policy world in order to strengthen your own position within your own citizenry that might be a danger, might have dangerous impact in other places. And I think we have to be concerned about that. Now, remind yourself, didn't we just lose a drone?
We just lost a drone.
And we don't know whether we lost control of it or it was taken from us.
Right. And the big question is, you know, where was it, quote-unquote, taken down?
It was a very, very advanced drone, one of our most advanced.
Right.
That's a concern we've got.
Yeah. Al, you were nodding your head as Bob was speaking. You agree with Bob on this, that we're not seeing another uprising like we did in 79, but there's still enough to be concerned about.
Exactly. I don't think you're going to get a carbon copy of what went on before, because things are different. If the president were to lose, that's good news and bad news. It's good news that that crazy man would go away. It's bad news that who would take over?
Well, it would be someone who would be even more in line with the very conservative and anti-Western Ayatollah.
That's my point.
Yeah.
If the president leaves, you then you go back to Khomeini. And that's not.
I mean, Alan, should we be thankful the fact that, you know, Ahmadinejad is in fact the lesser of most evils coming out of Tehran right now?
I don't take any great pleasure at looking at Ahmadinejad. He's a crazy guy and he's a dangerous guy. And I would like to see him go, not because I want other forces to be stronger, but let's face it, there are deep divisions inside Iran. We know that. And those divisions aren't going to go away if Khamenei dies or if Ahmadinejad should step aside or something happened to him. They are deep divisions and not going to change. In terms of what will happen, I didn't predict in 1979 what would happen, and I think there was a lot more spontaneity to that than there was in this particular case. I would never presume to speculate or guess what might happen now. I think the key, though, is that the West needs to stick together, that this wasn't the U.K., and that's why the French peeled most of their folks out of Iran right behind Great Britain. And we have learned, I hope, we have to constantly relearn that when we operate in alliance with countries with similar interests, we do a lot better in this world than when we go it alone. And that's what it's my hope that the West will stay together in this.
Just one quick thought. That's a very important point that Alan is making, because remind ourselves when NATO and the West decided to get into Libya, we worked together as a team. We were doing some things with more or less reconnaissance and supplies and all that kind of stuff, and we and the French and the British were all working together, and it came out very well from the standpoint of getting rid of a bad guy, and hopefully getting some kind of a success in some kind of a new government. But the fact of the matter is, when we work together, we do a lot better than we do when we go off on what we lawyers would call a frolic of our own.
Well, you know, it's funny because the one country we have not talked about in this whole genre is Israel. Israel has said that they are considering, Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister of Israel, has made it a point to say that if they do fire up what appears to be nuclear weapons activity, they will take military strike. The problem that Netanyahu has is that he's in a divided country. Only 48% of the population poll in Israel agree with what Tel Aviv is putting out there. Only 42% and 42% disagree, and another handful are undecided. Is Israel, and I'll go to you, Al, on this one, is Israel a catalyst? Do we have to have our coalition in line with Israel, or should Israel mark step and follow the direction of what the NATO allies are doing?
Well, I'm glad I'm not running for office. I think that Israel should follow along with a general approach. This does not please the Jewish population, Israel, and therefore the Jewish population in the United States, which, as we all know, they're very powerful politically.
Right.
So I don't know whether that can come about, but ever since Netanyahu has taken over, I have been very, very, very uneasy about Israel's approach to almost all the international affairs in the region.
Alan?
You know, I hope that Israel will be part of this larger body of countries. It's paying close attention. It understands the risks of going alone. But Israel's going to protect its own interests. We are not at risk from Iran. Europe is not at risk from Iran. Israel is next door to Iran. This is like saying if Mexico was having a huge influx of people into the U.S., would we go talk to Europe and Israel? Gee, what do you think we should do? Should we get tough with Mexico or not? We're going to protect our interests. They will protect their interests. Hopefully, they will find that their interests are consistent with the views of NATO allies, but you never know.
Bob?
One of the things that I think probably concerns Israel more than anything else is that the Arab Spring does not appear to be bringing to power what we would call, folks who have
moderates.
Yeah, and it looks
Democrats.
Yeah, you know, or Democrats. You know, they're losing out. The people who were in the square in Cairo are not the ones who are winning, it looks like, the elections. It looks like the Muslim Brotherhood, which is...
a more conservative Muslim sect. Yeah,
but they are very much an Islamic organization. Now, that doesn't mean they're crazy on Islamic, but they're an Islamic organization. And that appears to be also some of what's happening in some other places. Now, what that means is, from Israel's standpoint, is they're going to be surrounded by... I mean, Israel may very well repudiate the treaty they've got with... Egypt may repudiate the treaty that they've got with Israel. Maybe Jordan will feel... And if that happens, maybe Jordan will feel required to do it, too.
But, so, you know, remind yourself,
Syria may fall within the next 90 days.
But King Hussein has always been a very moderate force keeping some stability in that relationship between Egypt and Israel, and for the most part, the rest of the Middle East and Israel.
But remember, the first country was not Jordan. Jordan followed Egypt.
Correct, correct.
Yeah, and Jordan is a relatively small player in the world. Egypt is a big player in the Middle East, and it's going to be Israel is getting themselves, without doing anything serious about it, I mean, the neighborhood is getting a little more dangerous than it was before.
Yeah. Ralph?
And I think part of the problem is Netanyahu. People do not like and or respect him. They perceive him as being a racist. And there's this talk that it would be the Likud party that could create a peace agreement, but it would have to be without Netanyahu because he has alienated so many people. And with only 50% support in Israel for a strike, he's really on his way out if he does not find a way to exercise full leadership.
We spend a lot of time worrying about what Israel is going to think about our policy.
Yeah.
I would like to see a little evidence that Israel spends a little time thinking about what the United States is going to think about their policy.
Yeah, but you've got organizations here in D.C. like AIPAC that are going to disagree vehemently.
But the Arabs would agree with you.
Hold on, Alan.
The Israelis spend a lot of time thinking about what we're going to do. We give them billions of dollars. They don't ignore us. Having said that, they're going to pursue their interests as they see them, and they're going to try to persuade us. Yeah, they've got some people with some influence, no question about that, but make no mistake, they spend a lot of time and effort trying to keep us on board, understand what we're doing, but sometimes they're going to differ, and then they're going to hope that when they do differ and take an action that somehow it'll get smoothed over, they may go too far at some point.
Ralph?
What's going to be interesting, there's talk that the U.S. may cut off its access to the central bank. Now, this becomes problematic because it would hurt other countries.
What do you mean?
Like Japan, they get their oil through funding from the central bank.
Okay.
And that would be
What central bank?
The international funds.
The World Bank?
Yeah. The funds.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
The IMF.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Because there are a lot of countries that work through the U.S. to get their funding, like Japan getting the oil.
The other country we haven't talked about, and it's been strained for many, many months now, is Pakistan. Pakistan has been very antagonistic in some instances. Most recently, the drone issue. They were saying that we had the drone over Pakistan, which is part of our agreement. The drone was shot down and went into Iranian airspace and landed in Iran. But Pakistan seems to be somebody that we're playing with on very delicate eggshells. Is Pakistan a friend or is Pakistan an enemy, or do we not have enough information about it? Bob?
Pakistan has always been of two minds, in my view, which is that, yes, you know, we want to be a friend of the United States. They've been helpful and all that, but they're pursuing their own interests, and they have been injecting themselves into Afghanistan forever. And what they are concerned about is that any government in Afghanistan would suddenly become a friend of India, who is their enemy, and they're worried about having an enemy on both sides. And they have all, that is the reason that they have that particular group of Taliban, I can't think of the name, Harlequin or something?
Yeah.
Who are obviously being paid by the ISS, the military service.
The ISI.
You know, Pakistan military operations, they're being paid to be effective in Afghanistan. And, you know, and basically what their goal is to make sure that Pakistan has influence in any decision making that is, you know, deciding how Afghanistan wants to operate.
Alan.
The fact of the matter is, Pakistan is our friend, and they are an unreliable friend. Pakistan is our ally. They are an unreliable ally. We have no choice but to continue to have them as our, quote, friend and ally, unreliable as they are, because they have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And they are strategically placed where close to some people who are our bitter enemies, who harbor terrorists, and that we need to be able to use their airspace and their land to go in. So we give them billions of dollars. We buy their friendship. We buy their alliance. And we don't know what we're getting, but they are all of those things and highly unreliable.
Congressman Al.
It's a very good thing that I have never had anything to do. They're saying I'm not close enough to the microphone. Now hear this. They are... it's a good thing that I'm not a part of the State Department, because I get very, very, very frustrated with this delicate balance that Alan has just beautifully described. And I'm afraid that I'd wake up one morning and say, to hell with it, they are not our friends, they are not our allies, and I would develop a whole new strategy around that, which means you got to deal with the fact that they've got the bomb and all the rest. But personally, I have a lot of problem with all this tippy-toeing around people who I believe are not our friends. They are friends of convenience, and that's friends of our convenience some of the time and their convenience some of the time, but it's not a true friendship, and I don't trust that.
The problem is, when you've had pro-Western governments in Pakistan, they've ended up becoming very corrupt, like the Benazir Bhutto government and even her father. And that has not played well in our favor. And it's made a lot of Pakistanis resent.
We backed a lot of the wrong people. We
right.
did, particularly during the years of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
If you were anti-communist, you could be the devil, but we would send you money and missiles and all the rest.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so there's some of that, too. As I say, I just don't think I'm subtle enough to ever be involved in foreign
right.
policy.
Well, last question is, can we afford to have any more strain placed on the relationship between Pakistan and the U.S. right now? Congressman Al?
No.
Alan?
I don't know how to respond. There's constant strain, more, less, up, down, and we just muddle through.
Is there a breaking point?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we just this last week, we were in an incident where 24 of their people were killed by our weapons. And apparently we were shot at first. But nonetheless, we're the ones who did the killing. And they said, no more drone bases. So we'll muddle through that one. We'll muddle through time after time after time. But I don't, I wish we had the choice that Al suggests. I don't think we do.
Bob?
I don't believe it.
We are tied to Pakistan by very real interests, as far as we see them. We're going to have to continue to have a relationship with them. It is never going to be comfortable, and the more stress that is, you know, more stress with the war and the problems and the Taliban working out of portions of Pakistan and the ISI, the Pakistan Military Intelligence Operation, working with the Taliban in order to maintain a position of power and authority in Afghanistan, in order to be able to play Afghanistan against India. The reality is that it's a very complicated relationship, and it's going to continue that way, and it ain't never going to be pretty.
By the way, we've got breaking news coming out of Washington, D.C. FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt has just resigned and left the FAA as a result of following one day after he being placed on temporary leave following a DUI arrest here in the National Capital Region. So Randy Babbitt is out as the head of FAA. That's a little bit shocking because he's been one of the better FAA administrators that the agency's had in a long time. But unfortunately, the city of Fairfax, Virginia felt, and it has a policy now, of if you are a public official above the rank of GS-13, if you're arrested, we're going to publicize it, which I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Bob, what do you think?
I don't know.
Anyway,
having never been arrested for DWI, I suppose I think there is maybe some merit to that. But on the other hand, I'm not so sure that an absolute policy on, you know, first offense, public embarrassment is necessarily the best thing.
I think the city of Fairfax having to take down a really solid administrator of the FAA, especially with the fragile nature of our air traffic system right now, I'm not sure that's a good idea.
I don't blame
the Fairfax government. I think that if a guy is driving in the middle of the night down the wrong direction, drunk as a skunk, that we ought to know. And then it's up to the administration and the organization to decide what to do about it. It's not somebody's rule about publicizing. I publicize every arrest of somebody who's DWI, DUI. But that was the administration's call. It's always unfortunate to see somebody take that kind of fall. But hey, don't do the behavior in the first place.
Let me speak. I got a DWI. Fairly recent. And what I have found in the process is that from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, the rules are different.
There's no encompassing enforcement.
My lawyer said if I had gone 300 yards more, I would have been out of the Arlington jurisdiction and into the Alexandria jurisdiction, and the whole thing would have been treated differently. So I'm not saying you shouldn't arrest people for DUIs. I think that's a serious problem. But getting inside and finding that you've got totally different ideas of how you deal with it and what the penalties are and what have you from local jurisdiction to local jurisdiction seems to me to be confusing and unfair.
Wow. We're going to let that be the last word on that. That's the latest breaking news out of Washington. Got a few minutes left. It's my favorite part of the show. It's my part where we talk about buzz, hearsay, rumor going on inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway. It's my part. Tell me a story. We're going to start with Ralph. Ralph, tell me a story.
Okay, there's been a lot of talk as to why Obama has not apologized to the Pakistani government for the death of the 24 soldiers. What's interesting is that an investigation is going to show that the Pakistanis actually fired on our troops first, and then we killed the 24 soldiers.
Interesting. Yeah. Bob, tell me a story.
Going back to the Republican nomination process, I think it's going to be difficult for Mr. Gingrich to maintain his strong lead in the polls. I think a variety of people are going to be talking about his background and record, and I think he's going to have a hard time in moving quickly enough to strengthen his popularity, which is now based upon his excellent showing in the debates. And he needs troops on the ground in several states. He needs money for advertising and staff. And right now, I don't think he yet has enough.
It's a money race for Newt.
It's a money race as much as anything else, but it's also a fact that he's going to have to explain his record because people are going to be talking about it.
Alan, tell me a story.
Last week, I was at an extraordinary event that resonates with some of the themes we talk about here. The organization where I spend my day is called the Stimson Center, a
very well-respected organization,
think tank here in Washington, where I'm a fellow.
had an event that was a tribute to Leon Panetta.
Wow.
And Panetta, they annually have a tribute. Panetta was this year's honoree. And the thing that was extraordinary, here's this guy, 73 years old, came out of retirement basically in Northern California to become the head of the CIA and then moved over to defense. Doesn't have to do all of this stuff. He's been budget director. He was chief of staff for Clinton. He was running a nice little policy institute in Northern California and living on his family's walnut farm, his son of immigrants. The thing that really got me was a tribute to him by a Republican sitting congressman named Mike Rogers from Michigan, who is the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. It was funny. It was warm. It was personal. He said, "This man is the guy who healed the wounds between the CIA and the Congress." He told stories about getting Osama bin Laden. It was, as I said, hilarious, but warm and wonderful. And I thought, we need more of this. I'm glad I got to be here.
Amen.
It was a special evening.
Amen. 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 Amen to that. Al, tell me a story.
I will. Let me just make an addendum. I did not make my earlier remarks with regard to the DUI, which technically was just a reckless driving charge. I was not suggesting that I was ill dealt with.
Right.
The process was totally fair. I was simply trying to make the point that jurisdictions should get a little more.
No, I think that's a very valid point.
Now, I think there is something wrong when Ron Paul keeps this consistent degree of support totally ignored by most all of the media. And I am not at all sure that later on he's not going to pop up, whether that's because he runs in a third party, which will draw from Republicans conceivably, or whether he's going to surprise us more. But I think Ron Paul is not getting enough focus as to the role. I don't think he's going to be the nominee, but the role he could play in that whole process and in the general election as well.
Interesting. Interesting thought. Last minute and a half here, want to talk about it came out in an obituary over the weekend that the Washington political scene lost a truly great statesman back in November. Al, you want to talk about that for a second?
I'm talking about Carlos Moorhead.
Yeah.
Carlos Moorhead, I don't know that I would call him a great statesman. I would call him a great... He was a gentle and gentleman who did his job and was, I think, I was enormously fond of him. And Bob, you were a close friend of his.
And I feel the same way you did, Al. He was not one of those guys who made a lot of headlines. He was very, I wouldn't say he was diffident, but he was not aggressive in his attitude. He was a wonderful guy, a good person, an honorable man, and we could use more people like him who aren't showboats but are workers.
Yeah, amen. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the Moorhead family. Obviously, we could use more like Carlos Moorhead here in Washington. Always use that type of metal, that type of human being. Is always a valuable resource here in the political scene here in D.C. 30 seconds left. On behalf of Congressman Al, Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, I am your moderator, Justin Russell. We thank you for listening. Join us next week, next Tuesday, 4 to 6 Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio, and we'll talk about the latest stories coming outside of Washington. This has been Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1361 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital.
The place to be, particularly on a gray day.
You got it. Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Woo!